Well, boys, we're back. Durbo, Tom, welcome back to another episode of The Communique. Southam, how are you, buddy?
Good, mate. Just back on my couch after the Ardennes. So got to see Durbo at breakfast. Didn't buy me a beer after the quiz the other day. But I guess it was 7 o'clock in the morning.
The Durbo!
I was waiting for it.
What? That's a deal!
I didn't even stay at the same hotel as you.
You did.
We were at the Vanderbilt.
We did the exact same thing as your DS because we had to change hotels that night. So we had the exact same setup. I met Peva and Peter Weening. We were doing the same thing.
So to be fair, I got in at 1 a.m.
But
Flesh Malone.
fair enough. I'll let you off, mate. I'll let you off.
Well, guys, in case anyone doesn't know, this is Life in the Peloton. It's a Life in the Peloton production, and that is made possible by our partner, MAP. The Race Communique is exclusively being brought to you by the Escape Collective. And, well, this is fun because we're on the eve of the Giro and the Escape Collective Fantasy Competition. It's the simplest and most fun fantasy competition in the world. I did it last year, so I was like, what is this thing? I don't know. Halfway through, it sucked me in because I got a few things wrong. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? Have you played this before?
I haven't played it yet, but I've familiarized myself with it.
Well, I'll run you through it. You got to select one rider a day for the Grand Tour. So in the Giro, I reckon we should definitely play it. We select one rider a day. That rider accumulates points depending on where they finish in the stage. The twist is you can only choose one rider a day throughout the whole Grand Tour. So if you use Pog day one, you can't use him again. So on vice versa, if you use Caleb Ewan, you can't use him again. You've got to be strategic in when you use your riders. The best bit is we have got a Life in the Peloton league, a mini league that all your friends can come over. You can make your own mini leagues as well, but we've got the special Life in the Peloton exclusive one where we're going to be on it and everyone else can sign up too. If they want to come across and battle against us, that's the escapecollective.com/LITP. Go across and sign up because it's going to kick off. See if you can beat Southam, Durbo, and I. Durbs, mate, you're going to be kicking back. You should have inside knowledge.
My family's done Giro tipping every year for the last couple of years, so I'm not to this scale, but I'm ready. I've won the last couple of years. We get to win a vinyl each, so I'm pretty confident that I've got the inside knowledge. I could just text a few riders who are racing. You guys got no chance.
Southam?
I tell you what, I am pretty looking forward to basically having a 21 rider team at a Grand Tour, right? And you can just, you're just substituting everyone every day. It's like, oh yeah, thanks for trying. See ya. It'll be interesting because, you know, it's like you can't use someone. You might want to save someone, but then if they, you know, something happens to them, then you can't use them later on. So it's going to take a little bit of, I guess, be a little bit strategic, trying to get there, stack it early, I reckon. Stack the results early and hang on.
Well, there's going to be prizes from the Escape Collective at the end of the Giro. They're going to run it for the Giro, the Tour de France, the Tour de France Femmes, and the Vuelta. So there's plenty of leagues going on, but let's kick it off with the Giro. But, well, let's start with part one. This is my part, racing. There's been so much racing over the last month. Like, I don't even know if we can even be bothered going back to the Cobble Classics. I'm not even going to go there yet. Let's start with what is on the front of our minds, the Ardennes. Amstel, Flesh, Liège. Should we go backwards and talk about Flesh, Liège first and then wind back? Or should we actually, let's start with Amstel because that was an interesting race this year. And I'm just going to start with it. Pidcock opens up the Ineos account. First win for the team this year. Couldn't believe that. I was looking at it. Is that wrong, Southam? What's the other win?
Every time you did it. that one time.
Entirely one stage of Camino.
First World Tour win, right. That's where I must have got it wrong. Right. Better double check my stats there. Well, Pidcock did the double, actually. He did Roubaix-Amstel, 17th and first. Next best was MVP, first and 22nd, the double. Durbo, you did the double, mate. How was it? I always found that funny coming across after Roubaix. Look, when I say found it funny, I did it once. I hated it. Absolutely hated it because it's just every single time I did that. I don't know how many times I did it, but I said I'll never do it again. And it's just a bad combo.
I mean, depends on what you are. My role in AMSL is completely different to what my role is in Roubaix. Roubaix, you're sort of trying to go get into the final. Unfortunately, Roubaix this year, I had stomach problems and I ended up having to abandon about 30K to go. Just been having some issues with my gut there, so we've get to the end of that. But then AMSL is more just supporting Michael Matthews as long as I can. So, it was pretty uncomplicated for me. I think we did quite a good job for Bling and he was 10th. He's had a pretty good spring. So, yeah, it was all right. I mean, I don't like the accommodation, the same as you. It's sort of like you come off Roubaix and going, all of a sudden you've got to start climbing, you know, over 3,000 meters of climbing and you're sort of like, I'm not ready for this. I think the team's pretty good.
What about the peloton, the mixed peloton? That's the thing I'm talking about I struggle with. It's just this, you got all these guys who are fresh, gunning at it. They've been waiting for their chance to get into their classics, the Ardennes, and you're just like this sassy, tired cobblestone guy like, mate, don't even start me.
It's a lot easier, the Ardennes, in terms of positioning. Like, you know, you can pretty much look head and shoulders over half the peloton. So you're like, you're never really worried about, you know, hitting a curb or anything because you can see over everyone. The only issue is you get real angry because it starts to get real hard. Like in the Flemish classics, you just use your body weight and your skill to move into position. But here, the climbers and the Ardennes riders, they just use their legs because they're going uphill. So you know you have to be in position, but you're like, I just can't move right now. Like it's not because it's single file. You could easily move if you had the legs, but you just don't have the legs. We're going uphill. It's 13%. And I can't move. So you're a bit like, if I had the same brain, about 60 kilos, watch out, we'll win the Ardennes.
How are you feeling at the start of Amstel when it took like 45 Ks for the break to go or something stupid? Because normally it goes kilometer 9 just before that little town and the bridge and it's done. And this year it was just going and going and going for the combination because we had none of the big favourites. Like, well, Van der Poel was there, but it wasn't like, okay, UAE's definitely going to ride, you know, because they were trying to go in the move. Visma were trying to go in the move. It was a much more complicated start and it took a long time for the break to go there.
It was very weird. Like I said, I've done Amstel, I don't know, probably 6 times and or maybe more, and I've never seen the break take so long to go. And I was so blown away, like you, Tom, like when UAE's trying to put themselves in the break there. It was just like, I had no idea what was happening there. But I want to say fair play to Ineos, to be honest. They just, like, Pidcock hadn't really showed that he was, I mean, he obviously had a good result in Roubaix, 17th, but it's not like a from the start we're going to start riding. And Ineos just took it up from the beginning and they rode. And obviously had lots of confidence in Pidcock and he proved to back the team's confidence in him up. So, yeah, I was a bit like, oh, shit, Ineos, that's a bit weird. I even actually spoke to Vermeesch from Alpecin. I said, you're a bit lucky Ineos is riding for you guys today. He said, yeah, they're pretty confident. They have big plans today, like almost sarcastic. They've got big plans, you know? And they obviously did, and they backed it up and won the race.
But I mean, I had the feeling once I saw them start riding, it's like, they're kind of like, we're going to show you that we're backing you by riding. And then you get a better performance out of the leader. It's like, no, we're going to commit. We back you. You can do it. You know, because obviously he crashed at just before Basque Country. So he missed Basque Country and then last minute entry into Roubaix. You could be forgiven as a team of being like, we're not sure how you are, let's see. But I don't think that gives the right impression to a leader. And they just went, nah, we're going to back you.
I mean, you guys did that quite a bit, not riding per se, but I would say like you guys did that also in Flesh. You did that a little bit in Amstel. Also maybe a bit in Liège. Like you had guys like good numbers actually, quite a strong. I mean, without the podium, I'd say you guys had quite a strong Ardennes there with a good group.
Weirdly, it's like actually the like results wise, the first time I think I've ever done it when we haven't come away with a podium or like at minimum a couple of like top tens or something, you know? Because I mean, our team is really well suited to those races, much more than the cobbles per se. You know, the cobbles we normally have like a few guys, but in Amstel the Ardennes, we have a lot of the right profile riders. And then when you have that group, it's sort of motivates everyone for success. And, you know, I mean, Ben was fourth at Liège last year, so he was obviously up for it. It's a strange one because like everyone I've spoken to has been like, oh, your boys did well. And then you still feel like, you know,
yeah, it's so tricky, tricky to define what actually works and whatnot. But I would say that you boys, positioning wise, you guys had the squad, you were in the right place at the right time from an educated point of view.
Yeah.
Had a good ride, probably good DSing, you know.
Yeah, mate. Well done. From you just go first wheel into the bottom of La Redoute. Yeah. Great plan, DS. Yeah.
From an educating first, Turbo. Speaking of flesh, that's actually what I wanted to ask you because the weather was...
Here you go. Stevie Williams. Here we go. How many minutes into the podcast are we? And you've already found a way. Right.
Yep, my man wins. Picked him out. I've been on him all year. I've got my money on him.
He's not doing the Giro, Mitch, so you're going to be buggered.
Matter, he's building to something good. Stevie, amazing ride. But I wasn't necessarily going to talk about that first off, even though it was a really great ride. 44 finishes. But one thing I did notice was when the weather was going down, there was one team that I felt like had the heads up. And I was like, their DS knows what's going on here. And it was EF. EF was the team who kitted up. One of the first, if not the first team, went back for jackets. You guys can tell me otherwise. I only saw it from the TV, so I could be wrong. Seemed like you guys were a bit ahead of the curve there, and it worked out well, whether it was the being wrapped up better or whether it was just the riders were better or not. You guys had more guys than not in the final than the other teams. You know, UAE had no riders left. All the big leaders were falling away. Toons, Pidcock, Skelemos, they're all falling away. EF... Salim, I want to know what was the heads up and pretty much what happened in flesh.
I mean, with the weather, we did not know it was going to snow, but I knew it was going to rain. So because it's the problem for a lot of riders was that it was actually really sunny. It was 16, 17 degrees on some guys' head units. So a lot of guys came back and started taking clothes off. And the one thing that I will say that I did do is I said, okay, it's going to, because I was checking the radar, it's definitely going to rain at 2 o'clock because I could see the cloud coming and the wind direction, which is when we hit the first Moor. So it's like, don't get lured into a false sense of security. Then like you could start seeing the black cloud kind of to the left of us. And it's like, okay, this is going to be pretty severe, but nobody knew. Certainly we didn't know it was going to be as cold as it was, but I have to give most of the credit to the riders because you've got to want to be in the race to just keep going then. And the reason why they were so visible is because they were at the front and they were in the race. And that's, there were definitely guys who didn't have enough on. And if you came to put a jacket on, it was the end of the day. You just weren't getting back, game over. But our guys had a combination of keeping their clothes on, but also they were in the race to do the race, you know, that they just stayed focused on that and didn't get distracted by it. And I think UAE just panic rode because they had Almeida getting a jacket when they started going fast with Novak. Obviously no finishes in the end. So, yeah.
What was it like, Turbo, on the road? Because you rode flesh. Is it the first time you've ridden flesh?
First time.
Nice. Baptism of fire. What was it actually like? Because, you know, 44 finishes and watching it on TV, I was like, it's not that bad. Like, seriously, come on.
To be honest, it was pretty horrific. I mean, I think me personally, I had like a bit of an experience. I was actually left Amstel, went to Andorra, was in Andorra, got a call up Tuesday morning and then got a bus back to Barcelona airport, got into the Van der Valk at 1 a.m. for flesh. I mean, when it happened, we were in front row and I de-kitted. I had a little baby vest on that I'd carry all day. I was like, if it's going to rain, it's 17 degrees and maybe it's going to drop to 13 degrees, but it's going to be fine with the jacket. So we'd actually just moved into position for the climb before Moor, and then it just started coming down and we were right there when it happened and we just froze. Now pretty much our whole team was underprepared, I would say. Like I spoke about this in the meeting afterwards. We had no finishes as well. We had a pretty stern meeting afterwards saying what went wrong. And as it was, no one really knew. Like, we were the same as Tom. Like, yeah, we knew it was going to rain, but we didn't know it was going to drop 10 degrees and snow. No, but like these days, it probably happens about three in 1 year. You know what I mean? This is one of those days, just like epic. So we had to sort of like plan going forward, like, all right, what are we going to do next time? And like, we know when it rains in Belgium in March, April, it's freezing and it can be apocalyptic. So we kind of just needed light jackets ready to go and we were ready. I think it was pretty poor, I guess, just from the rider's side of things. I think the riders, we try to stay positive, but in the end of the day, like I couldn't break. I had like black legs, like looked like I had frostbite all over my legs and So at one point, I was the last guy left in the bunch from the team, and I was only there just to do the job. And we raced at the Murder Hoy, so it was the one to go. I exited the peloton and went to the bus.
So what I'm wondering what happened with these guys, the 44 guys that got through, obviously kitted up, but I think in these kinds of days, no kit sort of gets you out of it. No kit coming from your rain bag anyway, unless you're stopping and pulling, you know, full bibs on and everything. Stevie obviously goes well in the cold because he wasn't just, you know, wouldn't even say lucky, but got to the bottom of the climb and had a good run up, you know, the Murder Hoy the last time. He was all over the race. He was attacking all day. His second time up the Mur, he hit off the front as well. He's just looking strong all day. He was essentially the best rider in the race, won the race, I felt.
On a day like that, it literally is so different. It becomes like the best rider is just the best rider. So you see that all the years I've done Flesh, if you make one move at the wrong time, then your effort's basically compromised for the sprint at the end and your race is ruined. And this year, the sort of the five like riders who went away with a lap to go were, you know, four of the five, first five at the end of the race. You know, the whole podium went away. I mean, to be honest, if Uno X weren't there with their team, because I'd said to Richie, it's like, if you go here, you just keep going because nobody's basically left. But you, I've never seen that in the time I've been there where guys are making efforts and then also doing the sprint at the end. I thought it was a really great race, despite the fact people got, you know, frostbite.
It seems criminal, but I think we can literally go over Liège very quickly. Pog taking the piss there, riding away and essentially, you know, like I said about Roubaix, well, whether you guys heard this or not, I was saying it the other week, you know, Vanderpool sort of made Roubaix boring for me. And I hate that because the efforts that these guys are doing are so impressive. But, you know, as a fan watching it on TV, you know, you want to see these extreme weathers, you want to see these battles right to the finish line. But what these guys are doing at the moment, and even I was listening to an interview from Vanderpool after Liège saying in third position, I'm just not as good as this guy and I wouldn't be able to follow him even with my best legs. You know, he wasn't even trying to cover for anything. So I don't know, coming out of Liège, guys, was there anything that you guys sort of picked up or were we happy to sort of just move on and sort of leave that with the Masters?
Probably just one note I'd say is like probably Pog kept it tight. You know, he didn't go 80K to go. He only went with like 30K to go. So that sort of like kept the punters and the people involved in watching before they turned the TV off when it was. So, I mean, ASO must have had a chat to Poggy and just sort of said like, man, minimum 30K to go. That's all you can do. No earlier because people are turning off the TV. So that's probably it. Thanks, Pog.
Yeah, exactly. He's 7 wins from 10 days of racing this year. Not a bad start. Just before we sort of leave racing, I thought we can't not talk about the cobbles. I've just got some quick cobbles wraps, and you guys can say what you think as well if you don't agree or disagree. Who won out of the cobbles? What person or what team? You know, no crazy thing here. I reckon Vanderpool won first at Roubaix, first at Flanders, first at E3, second at Gent-Wevelgem, 10th at San Remo, if you want to call that a cobblestone classic. But, boys, can you compete with that? Who else won in your eyes?
I think Trek built a really positive classics team, and they were like, they had, you know, Schoons. Tom Schoons was a really revelation, like Podium, Estrada Bianchi, and like that whole squad. And then they had that huge crash, and it would have been very interesting, you know, like Mads Pedersen got the best of Van der Poel in Gent-Wevelgem. And if you had a, like a top of the notch, Mads Pedersen, you had a top notch, Jasper Stuyven, you had your Tom Schoons. I don't think anyone could have done anything about Flanders and Roubaix with Van der Poel. But I think the next best team was in the Flemish Classics was that Trek unit. And I think they just got to be lucky with that couple of crashes there. But that squad is really strong. And I think for the next couple of years, those guys are really going to be the best Classics team without the best Classic rider, if that makes sense.
Mm, totally. So who lost out of the cobblestone? Well, I've heard this nickname flying around, the Chihuahua Pack, the Quick Step. They've been yapping like Chihuahuas, apparently. I didn't. This is not my saying. Someone else said this. Their best results: Roubaix, Lampard 36, Flanders, Lampard 18th, Wavelgem, Mulier, Tim Mulier. He got up there at 8th. I guess you could call that something. Top 10, Lampard 26 at E3. The best result was 2nd by Tim Mulier in Dupin and 1st in Nokra Course. And he, I guess, he won Scheldeprijs, but for a team that dominates the classics, you know, 36th at Roubaix, 18th at Flanders. I can't imagine what the big chief's thinking.
It's quite a change. Like, it's all well and good to be, you know, thinking that you're going to transition into a different type of team, but still, you know, back in Remco for the tours, but still, guys like Lampard, who they were there before, it shouldn't affect them so much. You know, I was kind of, he's one guy who popped out to me as I was watching him at Flanders, just nowhere near where he was. And it's interesting to see how in a very short space of time, that dynamic of just invincibility in Flanders in particular has gone.
My revelation of the classics, and this is, again, no earth-shattering stuff, is Pithy. Lawrence Pithy, he was just amazing for me. I looked back. I didn't realize he was 15th at San Remo, 15th at Depan, 26th at Gent-Wevelgem, but his ride at Gent-Wevelgem was what impressed me, being with the big boys in the front. Flanders, he was 39th. And Roubaix, he had a great ride at 7th. He actually crashed. He would have been better than that as well. He's going to the Giro, so I see on the start list. I could be wrong, but he was awesome. I'm going to be really interested to see how he goes moving teams next year. Any guys that stood out to you guys who were on the ground? Well, Southern, you weren't there on the ground, but you were got your ear to the ground. But Derbs, you're in the bunch. Did anyone stick out to you? Anyone who rode you off the wheel that you're like, Jesus, who's this guy?
To be honest, Niels Pollitt, like, he had a massive change to UAE from Bora. He was already a good rider. But I find a guy like Niels Pollitt is not necessarily quick. You know, like a Stefan Kung, for example, they're around the mark, but they're never really on the podium. And for him to get a couple of podiums, always knocking on the door, ended up being podium in Flanders. He was fourth in Roubaix, potentially. Yeah, I think him going to UAE, that was just maybe for him a good signing for them, and then for him, he's obviously taken that new leadership up and really run with it. So I'd say, yeah, Niels Pollitt for me was a good one. We are here with Pella Chat this week. What I'd like to talk about is, I guess, a bit on the race nutrition side. We've obviously spoken about last month was the eating around races, monitoring how you eat and weigh things, always with the scales, etc. But now I'd like to chat about, like, in the race particular, I would say with the advances in race nutrition, we've been able to carry more food, more calorie on us for less size. So before, back when, you know, back in the ages ago when Tom and Mitch were in the peloton, so long ago, can't remember, back when they didn't wear helmets, we used to have a feed zone about halfway through the race, which had a musette, which is the bag full of food, had gels, bars, etc. So
a feed zone doesn't exist anymore.
They do exist, but I can't remember the last time a leader that I've ever worked for has grabbed a bag. I mean, not because they don't need it, but they just don't need it. So I think now all they are is just glorified crash zones. So you don't need it. So when I mean by you don't need it, when you start the race, I might be able to start the race with 6 gels and a couple of bars, which has ample enough food to get me through 4 hours with bottles. You come up to the feed zone, and what are you going to get from a feed zone? Another couple of gels and another couple of bars.
You're going to get that nice little panini. You know, you can sit back and slowly unwrap it and enjoy it.
The wasted calories. When you get a panini, you've got 20 grams of carbs at best. A gel, you might have 50 grams of carbs. So you're almost talking double from a gel. You know, we're not there for taste, are we? We're there for performance. So and yeah, so what I want to try to say is
I hate this now.
You would hate it.
What about the degustation of the day? Start the day with some, like, savory, move into the bus cakes.
No, mate, they're all just for the morning on the bus with the coffee, and then you pretty much just take normal food, you go off. Anyway, so what I would say is that now when we do a race plan in our team, we are more concerned about bottle points than we are with the feed zone. The common question is, if the race is over 4 hours, there may be a feed bag, but that feed bag will have 2 bottles in it with 2 gels, more or less, or 3 gels, which then would, in that feed bag, you could potentially have enough calories for another 2 hours worth of racing. That's how dense, how much carbs is in one bottle and one gel. So what we are doing now is on boulder points. Tom, I'll get you to chime in a second about this. The boulder points is like an intricate document about where you place people along the roadside to give you bottles. So now the way racing has become, we are racing so fast from the beginning. There is no moment to put your hand up and come back to the car and get some bottles. And, you know, my role as a domestique, you go back, you get, that bid and vest that was quite popular a few years ago. You don't often see that in the peloton anymore because of these bottle points. So no one's actually going back to the car and going, can I get a bottle?
Can I ask a question? Wasn't it illegal to give bottles from the side of the road at one point? Weren't they trying to like cram everyone into the feed zones?
It's all changed. They changed. You used to only be able to give bags in the feed zone. And then they changed it to you can give bags anywhere. And post COVID, the race organizers no longer make it an actual feed zone, which I think is one of the, like, safety wise is a huge point, because the feed zone was always so bad because there's 20 teams in there all trying to do the same thing. And if we're spread out now, I mean, even now though, like if you get to a big race, the bottle points, you're going to get a lot of different teams, but it just makes it a little bit more spread out. And you can do bags anywhere except in like just before or after a sprint.
So we then, exactly what I'm saying, with the bottle point document, you'd say that we designed, we'd have, for an Amstel goal was an interesting one. We had 19 points where you could grab a bottle. 19.
Are you memorizing
so we
that?
Had every single climb, more or less, maybe not every single, there might have been 26 climbs in Amstel. We had, so 19 of the 26, we had a bottle. We had three people there. We had water, we had carb, and we had big cup. And every bottle had a gel on it. So at every time, you could get at least 100 grams worth of carbs at each point. So you would, I mean, you could literally start a race with two gels in your pocket. And if you were confident that you would get a bottle from the side of the road, you wouldn't need to carry anything else. So you can imagine that.
Who's your nutrition sponsor? How many gels are you guys going through?
It's a lot of gels. It's a lot of gels. We got 60 actually. But I think the crazy thing about this is that the staff that you have to have. And, you know, for Amstel Gold, it's quite easy because you do circuits and you've got staff that can double up. But when you come to Grand Tours, this is where I wanted you to come chime in, Tom. Like, you have to bring a lot more staff to cover these points if you're going from point to point races. And it's just such a demand on the teams. It's like, like Tom, I'll let you come in now. Just sort of explain, like with your team, like, are you guys, bringing extra staff for Grand Tours just for these bottle points that have become so important?
Yeah. I mean, like you said, I mean, I basically, in the Ardennes, I gave one bidden. So I drove around with a like cooler, absolutely chock full of biddens, but all those races, and we gave one bidden from the car when somebody had stopped for a piss, basically.
You gave me one gel.
That was just kind of like,
I don't want it.
I gave you a gel on that climb,
yeah,
didn't I?
I need to get back on. It's having a hard time. Yeah.
But so when it comes to, we're getting used to the riders not coming to the car. Young riders don't even think ever of going to the car because they've never been, the guys coming in now are just like, oh, well, in 10K, there's going to be a bidden by the side of the road.
Wow.
What that means is, like, for my work around the Grand Tours, if I do, if you do bidden points, it gets really complicated with, especially the Tour de France, because of the road closure system. So they, at some races, you can skip from one place to another using a back road or a country road. But at the Tour, they close off all the like tributary roads into the main roads. So you can't even access the course twice, which means you can only do one bidden point per day, per team. Mm. And you need two people. Obviously, it gets hotter in July, and in the mountains, you want you want biddens at the top of the climb, possibly at the bottom of the climb, and you add in water for cooling. And it's getting to the point now where I started it last year, we bring in the service teams that we'd normally use at the classics for the Grand Tours. I know what Visma do is they use their VIP days, is they basically coach their VIPs into how to give a bidden. On Horticam a couple of years ago, they had 11 feed points up it's 11K climb. It becomes this huge, on every single day of a Grand Tour, I have to put, let's say, minimum 4, maximum 6 feed points, 2 people in each, and I have to do the puzzle as to how that's all going to work. And, then you have to tell the riders there's a bidden point coming. And I remember Jens Kukulet in a debrief a few years ago said, you need to tell us to the meter where the person is, because there's so many teams feeding, we need to know when to move over to the right. Everyone does looks at the map the same as I do, right? Every DS goes, all right, we're going to go here today. Then you come onto a climb and there's 22 teams. And to stay out of the washing machine, Jens's point was basically wants to know if we're right at the end, you can stay on the left as long as possible, then move up and do it. Because there's a lot lost in effort and energy and going back if you can't do it. And it's...
Yeah, it sounds like to me there's like about 6 to 8 feed zones in stages now. It's essentially just moving big feed zone into micro feed zones, and you're wishing the old system was there again, because there's one feed zone, easier to organise, plus guys come back to the car. As a DS, you're like, God damn it, I miss the old system.
You know what I wish they did? I wish they just every team just got together and we just got 4 buses, and because everyone's in the same spot. There's 2 go in front and they drop all these guys off, and 2 go behind and pick them all up, because it's good the idea. Vehicles as well.
Like you need that. To.
Everyone's going to be in the same spot. You know, how many times I see Geeta stood with, our guys. It's like, we're in the same hotel. You guys could have just carpooled.
Yeah. Now, that makes total sense. I mean, also even as a role, to go back for bowls at strategic times and when to do it, that was a bit of an art. You're just just before the top of the climb, you get dropped, you come back through the cars, get all the bottles, and then bang on the valley, you've got the bottles out and you've saved as much energy as possible. But I would say you're the right Tom, and he says young riders don't actually, they don't even ask. Whenever I stop at the pier, I'm just on the radio, I'm like, oh guys, just back at the cars, anyone like anything? No one actually asks for anything. I'm there, I'm using energy to be back there. No one's I'm just probably wait for the bottle point. So it is quite interesting, isn't it? How much it's changed. And I thought that was a good point to bring up. And it's not death to the feed zone. It's maybe death to the main meal, and it's more like a micro degustation throughout the day. So
right, so as it's the communique, I'm going to dive in with some actual real communique action here with the race finds. So at the end of every day, at the end of every race, you get sent out the results, which come sort of in a 6 or page document. Every race is different. Some are a bit more detailed than others. But the idea is every day it gives you the results, the general classification standing, a grid. With everyone's GC position and time that the mechanics then take out and use the next day to mark who's in the break and work out quickly, how close people are. Information for the following stage. And then at the very, very end of it, and it's always the first thing I go to every night, is basically where's the fines? Is the fines. At UCI, obviously love it because it pays for the whatever holidays those guys go
Christmas
on.
Christmas party.
But, I saw that there's some things you see that are obviously quite obvious and quite visible. Would have gone through it with Matthews, being disqualified at Flanders.
Yeah.
And then Tarling obviously being ejected, quite a high profile mid-race with a video referee getting thrown out of Roubaix, which, on the road is quite a big thing to happen, really. That's not a post-race fine. For that to happen in a race, I mean, to be honest with that one, I was watching TV and I saw it and I was like, whoa, that's out.
That was on the fence. Hey, mean, not even on the fence. That was just sort of pretty bad. I mean, it does happen quite a bit
over the
in
fence.
Roubaix when you have drop riders, people, jump on the back of the car, but not, this was sort of quite a long hold, quite a flight speed.
It's funny because, and I think going back to a group where something like that's happened is it's different if at the very, very back of the race where someone's not going to contest the final, or going into a dropped group or something.
I can sort of understand in a way there's, Stannard and there's Tarling, and they're both, Tarling's in his probably first Roubaix. He's doing a good ride and he just wants to get back and he doesn't feel like he deserved to, get dropped or crash or puncture or whatever. And I can be in that moment. I've been in that moment where I'm holding onto this bobble and I'm like, this is probably on the fence, if not over the fence, of how long I'm going to get this. But I so desperately want to be back in the race, and I feel, so I'm not going to say those, bloody cheaters. He's a young guy.
Nah.
Stannard's passionate as hell for Roubaix. They just wanted to get him back in the race. It's fair enough to be thrown out, but I don't think it's in that moment.
No,
it wasn't a planned move the night before.
launch,
I think everybody's
engage.
You know, everybody wants the same, you know, the same thing, and you can totally see how that would happen in the car and outside of it. So, but moving on a little bit after Roubaix, the bits that might not have been seen. So I've got the communique from Brabants Peel here, which is actually, I didn't do Brabants, but I saw a couple of things and I was like, oh, okay. So I got the DS there to send it to me.
Oh, nice.
So,
well done.
This is the one I saw was Pascal Eenkorn going up the pavement. So Eenkorn, Turgis and Seri, use of sidewalks, pavements, paths or cycle lanes that do not form part of the race route, 15 UCI points and 200 Swiss francs. So basically...
It's more the 15 points. The 200 Swiss francs is nothing.
No, the points is quite serious. I mean, because that's... Yeah. Put it into context. If you won a stage of Tour of the Alps, because this actually happened to us, you get 20 points. And if you throw a bid on, you lose 15. So Simon Carr, when he won stage 4, because I've got that communique as well, he won the stage, but also got 15 points for a bead on.
Oh,
so
no.
It's like a net gain of 5 points.
No
which is,
way.
That is a load of rubbish.
Literally.
Bidons has come back this year. So initially when they started with bidon throwing, they were quite strict. And then it got a bit more lax and they said, oh, you can throw them. Because remember they threw the guy out of Flanders, the Swiss, Mickey Schaar got thrown out of Flanders.
Yes, that's right.
And then they said, oh, you can throw a bid into the public, but it has to be uphill and there's all this sort of, but now they're back on it. There's quite a lot.
I think last year's Christmas party didn't live up to the year before and they're just really keen to just go out in a bang this year. Like, but also even with the footpath one, I would say they were pretty lax. They sort of started pretty hard on in the Belgium Classics. Like if you're on a footpath, you know, you're out of the bike race and I think they threw Luke Rowe out of the bike race or go on a bike path. You just see it now. It's just pretty much if it's attached to the road, you can ride on it. Everyone just goes for it. And then all of a sudden you have this Eenkorn one and Brabants Peel. But you watch Flanders. Like I was there in the bunch in Flanders. It was ridiculous how many people were using the bike path for an advantage. So you know what I mean? Like it's just like if you get caught, you're buggered, but it happens all the time.
Well, speaking of getting caught, this is one I found. I don't know anything about it. I don't know if you guys read about it or if it was picked up anywhere. Sander de Pestel, Decathlon Agir d'Azur. Deviation from the race route constituting an advantage attempting to be placed without having covered the entire race route.
So he took a shortcut.
Basically, but I don't know the story. I would love to know if you guys can find out. With
I have never seen
I've been 37th in San Remo and not finished the bike race.
Well, the other way around.
Yeah, I just went straight. I didn't go up the Poggio and they just let me back on course and then I just went across the finish line, went to the bus and then I went on the communique, you'd say. And I was like, I don't know, like 50th place, Luke Durbridge. I'm like, well, I didn't even do the Poggio. It wasn't intentional. They just guided me back on course. And I was like, oh, okay.
That happened to a bunch of us in E3 as well when we just sort of rode to the finish and we all rolled across the line, but we weren't as good as that. We're like 80th or something. I was like, yes, finished it.
But I mean, I'd heard legends of, you know, in Belgium, you used to be able to take a shortcut and this guy hid behind a bush and then jump back into the race and this guy was out. But I've never actually seen ever someone being...
What race was that from?
That's from Brabants Peel. So
he attempted to take it. This is the funny thing about it. He's attempted to take a shortcut, which is great. Like he's tried to hide behind the bush and they've just seen him squatting down there going like, hey, boy, what are you doing?
Nah.
Yeah, I hid behind a bush in Kern Brussels Kern once, but that was just because I didn't want the team car to see me abandoning. Because I wanted to be first. It was snowing. I wanted to be the first one back to the bus because I knew that. But there's no fine for just hiding from your team car. Moving on, Tour of the Alps, two motorbikes fined in 2 days for influencing the race, or which. I think if you watch that race, I mean, I've watched it a few times and I don't know how you guys feel, but when I watch races and I see like motorbikes influencing what's happening, it drives me nuts. So kind of good to know that, I mean, it's not great for them. Nobody wants to do it, but at least there's some sort of sanctioning going on motorbikes because when you watch the, not so much like the top level World Tour races, but like in a lot of the smaller races, you just see like, wow, that's having a huge effect.
But I don't get that then. Who's paying for that? Because the organization get them there. They're paying them to be there. So is the organization paying for that fine? Because because from what I understand, they're getting told where they're allowed to ride and what they're supposed to be doing through an earpiece during the race. So whose fault really is that?
It's if they don't, if they get told to move and they don't move in time, and they must have to pay out of their own pocket.
I had a good story with a motorbike in Kipigum, the one day race of Ultra Swiss. And I think they must have just, you know, Googled, you know, cameraman the day before the race. So they got this guy, and he's this real artsy looking guy, and he must have just more done wedding videos than filming a bike race. He comes on the bike, he comes on the race, and we were riding, and he just comes up with the motorbike, and they just literally just slots into the line, you know. So he's first wheel of the line, and we're like hard on like group motor pace, and he's sitting there just driving, he's filming us, he's loving it, he's big smile, he's like, yeah, like he's like, honestly, you can touch the camera, and we're riding for, okay, sweet. And they're just slowly the bunch just starts to get like decimated behind, and like next minute it's in two groups, and they're just, the commissaire's just like saying like, get off the front, get off, riders are yelling at him, and he's just like still there. He just has no idea, and we're just following him the whole time. He must have gone on for like a couple of minutes and like maybe more. And then eventually the commissaire car comes flying up and just like tore shreds off him. Anyway, so he goes into sulk mode, and he no longer like filmed the bike race. He rode off, and there was just no more footage. So he rode off, and he's just holding his camera on the side of his hip. Like he's just like, not like, so we're just, I'm not sure what people watch.
unless I can do it how I want to do it. Just,
doing scenic shots, you know, the whole time. Just wasn't even filming anything to the bike race. He was like, find him. I'm not filming. Oh, it was hilarious.
All right, I got one more find for you. This one was from Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday, and I won't mention the team to embarrass them, but let's just say they've been very successful this classics season. And their DS was fined 300 Swiss francs for urinating on a house. we actually saw it from our car. It was just like, it must just be brain fog during the race but still, like a house is still a house, whether it's on the route of a race or not. It's like 2 meters from someone's front door, just pulling your pants down and having a slash on the side.
So, it wasn't the neighbor's house, was it?
We should keep a couple of communiques in your pocket, so them for the future episodes. And if something funny like that pops up again, I love hearing about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll keep my eye out.
Well, boys, the Giro is next week. I thought we should do a little preview. I'm pretty excited about the Giro. I always liked watching it. It's the most beautiful race of the year. I didn't love riding it. I liked riding it after I'd finished it. It was one of those races that, I don't know about you, Durbo, but as soon as I finished it, like literally 2 days after, I was like, yeah, it wasn't too bad, actually. But in that moment, I actually hated racing that race. It's brutal.
It's super hard, yeah. Oh, it's still one of the best races, like you said, I think, when you look from the outside to like, I mean, I hadn't done the Giro in a few years, and 2019 I got called back in to do it last minute, and then like at the team presentation, I went to a bar and they just like shouted you a coffee and bought me a cake, and they're like, good luck on the Giro, and that just would never happen in France, you know. So they just love it there, the passion, and it's a really great race, and we had some great memories there as well, so... yeah, look back on it fondly, but yeah, as you're going to go through some of the stages in a minute, pretty brutal.
Well, yeah, we've got the community quiz after this, but I thought we'd just run over a couple of things. Like it's they've actually taken a new tack this year. The Giro typically is known for their epic long stages. I've even done a couple of back-to-back classic style stages there, 240 by 250 in the mountains. You're like, what is this race? This is ridiculous. This is like stages 16, 17 or something. But this year, they've only got four stages over 200K. Most of the stages are around 160. They've actually got a couple of shorter stages in there, 140K stage. The first week is full of like lumpy sort of sprint stages, like sort of a stage that suit Bingham Gramey. So there's some flatter sprinters stages there. But stage seven, they've got their first TT with an uphill finish to that TT. The first major stage is stage eight. There's a mountain day. I don't know, Durbo, did you ride Torino a couple of years ago? But this stage hasn't featured a couple of years ago at Torino, called Prati del Tivo, 15K at 7%, Pog one up there. I was just having a look at it before this. Don't know if that rings any bells to you, but that is the first big major stage. beat Yatesy up there.
No, I did Paris-Nice that year. So, but yeah, no, I mean, I haven't had a look at any of the course for the Giro at this point because I'm not doing it. And hopefully they get called up for it.
Well, stage 9 is the first one over 200, 214K, just before the rest day. The second week is looking pretty tough, but it goes crazy at stage 15, 220K stage, the Mortirolo, personal favorite. I've never raced up there, but I've groveled up there in a training ride and thought, there's no way you could ever race up this climb. This is ridiculous. And then they head up and finish in they go over the Foscano and into Livigno, some roads that I've done some training on way back in the day. They're beautiful roads to ride on. To race on these roads are just ridiculous. The last part of the last week, they're hitting the Stelvio first up, the Chimicopi. The highest point of the race is the climb to begin straight after the rest day, 202K stage. Oh, Derbs, can you imagine this? This is just straight up the Stelves, straight after the rest day, stage 16.
That is just, that's some that's, stuff of
that's
nightmares,
Giro written
isn't
all
it?
Over
like,
it, isn't it?
Like, what do you, yeah. what do you do, Tom, to like get people motivated on a rest day just to like, you know, like what would you do? I honestly would be fear of God. I don't know what I'll do.
The trouble is, it's like they're going to be sleeping up high, right? So I'd be really curious because it can be quite difficult to like when you have the first rest day in a grand tour, you're generally in a place where you can do like a 3 hour ride quite comfortably. But when you get up into the hills, if the weather's not good, if you're staying in the mountains, if you're at altitude already, you're not recovering the same. Restless sleep. And then we had this in 2021 at the Giro where we were staying in the mountains on the second rest day and it was just pouring with rain and the guys, they should have done a longer ride, but they didn't, you know, because they just couldn't find the roads and
they could do the tunnel, you know, the Livigno tunnel.
Yeah.
Like 16 World Tour teams just going up and down the tunnel.
Well, I don't know these days, but I've seen young guys do 2 or 3 hours on the ergo with no problems at all. So I'm just sure you get a few ergos up and everyone get on Zwift and do whatever they need to do. But no, I just think the hard thing with the Giro is the transfers. How do they look this year?
Mate, stage 20 to 21. Check that out. From it's basically like across the whole of Italy.
Finish at Monte Grappa. Where is Monte Grappa?
It's way up, basically near. It's like almost near Slovenia, and then they're coming all the way down to Rome. So it's like somehow they have to do that.
Those poor bus drivers. That's
two times up Monte Grappa. That's just epic. It's like it's just going to make for great viewing. I don't know. Quickly off the top of your heads, guys, let's just run through quickly one pick from GC Sprint. And breakaway. I wanted to just quickly chat about Pog and Thomas, who are going for the double, Giro Tour double. They're my ones I'm going to look out for. Derbs?
Yeah, obviously Pog, you know, I just hope he, you know, makes it for entertaining viewing for everyone. But I also will say is that like someone like Garrett, you know, I think the way this race just builds and builds and builds and the way he goes and gets better and better and better throughout the race, like, I still think he'll be second best to Pog there, which would be pretty impressive. And then obviously Ben O'Connor is obviously in great form. He's been prepping for this from the start of the year. He already said he would take off the tour. So he's in really great shape. Saw a tour of Alps all season, actually. He's been firing. So, yeah, I mean, I could see Ben O'Connor on the podium, I'd say.
Mm.
That would be fantastic. And I really think he could do it.
That good change for him, maybe it's going to give him that little bit that he's been just sort of, I wouldn't say lacking, I'm trying to look for the right word, but just something different where he can capitalize on it. Southern, is there anyone that's sort of, what about coming out of EF?
I mean, obviously Hugh still is starting the Giro. We've got Simon Carr there as well, who just won at the Alps last week. So like for us, it will be pretty standard sort of fair for the Giro. Hugh's obviously tried and tested in this race quite a lot. He loves the race. Third week like that with those long, hard stages, possibly bad weather, it's going to play into his hands. I'm quite interested to see how O'Connor goes. I mean, his team were really good at Alps. Both of those Paripantra brothers were really up there and doing well. So that's interest to me. Also, Tiberi was going well at Alps. He rides for Bahrain. The guy got fired last year for shooting a cat in San Marino. he was going well. And obviously, well, as well, I can see him on the start list bar day. He'll be in the top five, I would say, the way he went at Liège, obviously in good nick. And yeah, we'll be keen for a result. So apart from that, nobody, who else jumps out?
I would say that I think I'm backing Caleb in for quite a good Giro. Like, he's been away training quite a lot in altitude, and I just think a bit of fire in the belly, and I really feel like, yeah, he's up for some good stages. And yeah, like, I think this could be a bit of a, you know, not comeback, but, you know, back in the firing of being one of the best sprinters again. So I think it'd be good to see.
Yeah, he's got a lot to prove. I had him sort of penciled down. I'm really interested to see what Welsford does after that big start in Down Under, and if he can go on with it. He's got Van Poppel there leading him out, so I saw from some random start list. If that's true or not, I don't know. But be keen to see how he goes in the sprints. Just quickly, just to finish this, my man Pithy's there in the breakaways, hopefully, or in the sprints. There's a couple of tough sprints that suit him as well. Lastly, guys, anyone else that stood out for you? Should we just go straight into the quiz?
Are you not going to mention Stevie Williams, even though he's not riding? Just give him a shout out, Mitch. Go on, mate. Cheers. Go on.
Stevie, he'll be doing something amazing, no doubt. Let's get into this community quiz. Here we go. All right, boys, let's do this quiz. Tom, I took a lead from you last week and I've split it. So Durbo and Tom, separate quizzes, because it's a bit hard to put your hands up and all that stuff. So I'm going to crack in just because of what order I've written in. Durbo, you're first. You ready? Bit of Giro feel, bit of classics feel, and then a bit of cycling slang. In the one Giro we rode together in 2014, you pulled out on stage 11. I pulled out 4 days later on stage 15. Who actually won the overall of the 2014 Giro?
Oh, no, he didn't. 14, broke my collarbone. Wasn't Contador. Shit, I don't know, actually. I'm trying to figure it out. 14.
Time's up. Yeah, Quintana, right.
I did pull out. I broke my collarbone. Jesus. I know, but I mean, didn't.
I know, you pulled out.
Time cut, you know? Sick.
Who is the official beer sponsor of the 2024 Giro? Is it A, Peroni, B, Nasser Azzurro, or C, Chimay?
Azzurro.
Oh, bullshit. You know who it is? No, it's Chimay. Can you believe that? I could not believe when I looked that up. I was like, how could this be possible?
Not too well.
Bit of classics. Murderhoy, what does that actually translate to in English?
Mountain of Hoy.
Oh, you're so close, Devo. Think again. What does it feel like when you ride up it? It's like
a hill? No, steep?
It's like a wall.
Wall. There you go. Boy. You should know this one, Devo. This is pretty easy. What was the first team Tom rode on as a pro at the continental level? Was it A, Rafa Condor, B, La Pomme Marseille, or C, Amora Vita?
First team.
At the continental level.
Rafa Condor. Nah, because I think Amora Vita wasn't continental. Pro-Conti. Well, they were.
They were pretty sure they were. No, they were continental.
Pro-Conti. So pro-cycling stat says. All right, Derby, you should get this. What do these terms mean in cycling slang? LBS. A, long bike stop. B, lubricated big sprocket. Or C, local bike shop. These are actual terms I've found on a cycling slang website. LBS, long bike stop, lubricated big sprocket.
Local bike shop.
C,
surely.
Local bike shop.
Surely.
As well, Danny got one.
That was so bad.
2, what is a metric century? A, 100-kilometer ride. B, when you're riding with a cadence of 100 revs per minute. Or C, 100 laps completed on the velodrome. What is a metric century?
B?
It's actually 100-kilometer ride. Second last question. What is a pack fodder? It's a negative term used by more aggressive riders about those riding with a group who never take a pull at the front. B, a cyclist in a bunch who is wearing a fluoro reflective yellow jacket and has rear vision mirrors attached to their helmet and drop bars. Or C, a rider who jumps from group ride to group ride, never staying loyal to the one group ride. What is a pack fodder? Well done. All right, he's got two questions. And the last question for you, Dervo, is what does it mean when you've been tacoed? When you go so deep in a ride or a race that you are completely tacoed, it's referring to a meal consumed after a long day out riding. Or C, a term used to describe a seriously damaged wheel that appears to be folded over like a taco.
C, that sounds quite good.
Okay, well done, Durs. You got three questions there. Three out of, I don't know, a maximum of eight, I think it was, in the end. All right, Tommy, you ready? Let's do it, Southern. Who has won the Giro the most amount of times?
Fausto Coppi, 5 times.
Oh, well done. That was a trick question. There was actually 3 answers. Eddie Merckx and Alfredo Binder has also won it 5 times. So I'll accept that. That's one. Two, what is the difference between Peroni Red and Nastro Azzurro Peroni? One difference.
It's to do where it's made, isn't it? It's like one's imported and one is made locally, no?
They're both made in Italy.
They're both, I don't know. It's about, actually, I can tell you, it's about $11 in the, for a slab in the Doncaster.
I thought you were going to get this. This is a beer that you highly consume.
Yeah, it's
well, true. One difference is they're different in percentage. Green is 5%, red's 4.7, and red's an all malt lager. It's drunk a lot in Italy, and the green is a really exported beer. So on any of those, it was a bit of a tricky question, that one. So, Derbs, you got one back on him. Don't know if you'll get this one. It's Alejandro Valverde won Flèche Wallonne a record 5 times and Liège-Bastogne-Liège 4 times. 7 riders have achieved the Ardennes double, winning both Flèche and Liège in the same year. How many times did Valverde do it? The green bullet.
How many times did he get Flèche and Liège in the same year?
How many times did he achieve the Ardennes double?
He won 4 Lièges, right?
Lièges.
I feel like he did it. I feel like he did it Flèches. 3 times.
Oh, he plucked that one out of thin fat air.
No. Is it right?
All right. What year then?
So there's 1 year where he missed Flèche. I remember he missed Flèche, but he got Liège. I can't remember which year it was.
It's very good.
Yeah.
2006, 2015, 2017 was the 3 years he did the double. All right. This one's about Derbo. What was the first team Luke Durbridge rode on as a pro at the continental level? Was it A, Team Jayco Skins, B, SouthAustralia.com, or C, Mobius Future Racing? Would you like those answers again?
No, I want to say Jayco Skins.
You're going to lock that in?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that is correct.
Yeah.
Now into some slang. It's on the same website. Oh, I tell you what, I had so much fun looking through this website. Right. What do these terms mean in cycling slang? Corn cob, a cassette which each cog is only 1 tooth larger than the previous one. It's also known as a straight block. B, when you get spat out of the back of a fast working echelon, you get corn cobbed. Or C, just after you drop a load in the team bus toilet 10 minutes before the stage start and only to find the toilet paper roll was left empty, corn cobbed.
I'm probably going to go with A, Mitch.
All right. Well, that's correct. All right. LSD, what does that stand for? A, long steady distance, a training technique that requires a firm aerobic pace for at least 2 hours, long straight descent, or C, left side down. When you have an accident on your bike and have a full crash, a fall or a crash on your left side.
Why would you even say, oh, I had an LSD? Like, if that's really it, people need to seriously just try using words. I'm going to go for two because it's the B, because it's the only thing that makes any sense to me.
It's not. It's actually long, steady distance, a training technique that requires firm aerobic pace for at least 2 hours. All right, two questions left. Organ donor. What is an organ donor? A stronger rider whom you would love to trade your organs with. B, cycling slang for one who rides without a helmet. Or C, a cyclist who has literally donated or will donate organs.
One who rides without a helmet, I guess.
Brutal.
Yes, it is. Correct. All right. Lastly, mate, a tea party. What is a tea party? When a whole group of riders stop and chat and nobody seems to want to ride on. A team in a bike race who does not affect the outcome of the race. For instance, Quickstep were having a tea party in the classics this year. Or C, a cycling term used to describe a group of riders doing a guided European cycling tour. That's a tea party.
I'm going to go for the B just because I enjoyed that one the most. I really like to say that team's a tea party. And they're having a tea party. Don't worry about
that. Was, that
don't worry
was
about Quickstep today. They're having a tea party.
It is incorrect. It is actually a very good, guys. I think Southam actually won this Durbo. Yeah. Looks like you owe Southam two drinks.
Breakfast breakfast.
It has been a
next time Durbo. It doesn't matter if it's 7 a.m. Mate. Enough. Come on.
Really good, boys. Thank you for tuning in again. And I enjoy doing the quizzes. Thanks so
see
much.
See you guys.
Nice one.
Thanks.
That iconic music in this episode was composed by none other than the legend, Pete Shelley. Cheers, mate.